Welcome to another episode of the Mac Power Users. My name is David Sparks, and I'm joined by my friend and yours, Stephen Hackett. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, David. How are you?
I am great. I am great. And it's time for another feedback episode of Mac Power Users. As usual, our listeners have delivered the goods. We've got a lot of great questions and comments, and we have a whole discussion of the F-sharp major chord coming up. I mean, we got it all in today's outline.
We do.
I can't wait to get into it.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. A little bit of housekeeping. I'd like to thank everyone who ordered a shirt or a hat. Those orders closed a few days ago as this episode comes out, and things will be heading your way shortly. So you'll get an email once your merchandise ships. I'm super excited to get mine to rep the new MPU look.
Me too. I'm actually wearing a sweatshirt right now. So
nice.
I need to upgrade to the new one. You know,
I'm wearing a Cortex shirt.
There you go. Wearing the brand.
That's right. You know, most of my closet's Relay FM stuff.
Yeah, I need to do something about that. You know, have you ever seen like on TV when they like do the makeovers and their closets just have a few clothes? Mm-hmm. I aspire towards that. I think that's good. Like just have a few clothes, make sure they all match. You're good. But instead, mine, you need the jaws of life to get things out of it, partly because I have so many podcast related t-shirts and sweatshirts. today on More Power Users, we're going to get into a new task manager called Godspeed. Both Steve and I spent some time with it, and it's an interesting app, and it's worth discussion. So we're getting that in More Power Users. That's the ad-free extended version of the show. You can sign up for More Power Users over at relay.fm/MPU.
So let's get into some listener feedback, and we're going to start with a note that you got about cleaning keyboards.
Yeah, Hamilton wrote me, and he says, I'm surprised you did not suggest a small vacuum head for sucking out the crap we get in the keyboards. To me, compressed air just blows some of the garbage into the keypads. It depends. I think compressed air, if it's compressed enough, if that makes sense, usually gets things out. But I had to admit, Hamilton's got a point. If you've got a good vacuum, running a vacuum over it a lot of times is better because you can jam stuff in there. I think this is particularly true with the older keyboards with the bigger gaps where you're just blowing it around inside as opposed to kind of getting it out before it gets in. And one thing I'll say as a woodworker is I generally prefer using the vacuum over compressed air because why do you want to put all that stuff back in the air, right? Mm-hmm. You want to suck it out. So yeah, good point, Hamilton. We should have made that. I guess the reason why is just that you can get a can of air, you know, anywhere.
Oh yeah.
And it's kind of nice to just hit it. And with the new keyboards, the gaps are so small that I don't think there's as much risk as of blowing things in. But that'll be the next round of email people telling me how wrong I am about that.
And there are like anti-static vacuums. You don't want to use like your shop vac on sensitive electronic equipment. I'm sure it'd be fine on a keyboard, but you know, if you crack open your PC case, like you can't just stick any old vacuum in there because they have static discharge and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which is another reason I prefer compressed air because there's no real risk in that. And like I said, you get a can of air. They also have these little like little blowers you can get that are just, you know, sometimes battery operated that just, they're like a little leaf blower for your desk. Next, we move to the world of Apple Notes backups. This has been a bit of a recurring topic, this time from Matt Camper over on the forums. They back up their Mac's data using a combination of Time Machine, Backblaze, and, of course, iCloud. iCloud's not a backup. It's a sync engine. We've talked about the differences before. Comments on various podcasts about the need for an intentional separate backup strategy of iCloud data have always nagged me, but I've never done anything about it. They go on to write, and we've talked about this as well, Apple Notes, your data, it's not like a bunch of text files once you get to the bottom of the stack. It's a database with files, and it's not really human readable. And that does make backing up of notes more difficult. And we've talked about export options before a lot, but I'm kind of at a point with this. This has nothing to do with Matt Camper's comments. I just, in thinking about it, how it always comes up. At some point, if you're going to use Apple Notes, I think you just have to be okay with the fact that it stores things this way. And Time Machine and Backblaze, they're going to to be my backup options. I think if you really need notes as individual files on your disk, you've just got to use something else. It's not the way Apple works. And I'm okay with it because I do back it up in those manners. And honestly, I haven't had any sync issues in Apple Notes in a long, long time. So I don't let this keep me up at night knowing that it's backed up the way the rest of my data is backed up.
Yeah, that's kind of my feelings too. I am, I talked on the show about Obsidian because I already am an Obsidian user, and they reverse engineered the database. Is somebody at Obsidian did, and you know the idea was to get you to switch over to their app, but I'm just using it as a backup source, and I find that it does a pretty good job. You know, it doesn't necessarily, because Obsidian is a Markdown file, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not the same thing. But it does a decent job. But I'm with you. I kind of like have faith in the system.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Matt Camper, you and I are doing all the things. You know, we're online backing up, we're Time Machine backing up. I also make up just a backup. You know, I hook up an external drive every month and I copy over all the contents of my root drive and my iCloud data and everything. And I've got a couple of them I rotate through. So I'm not too worried about losing it. I'm also in a very comfortable zone with Apple and data sync at this point. I know doing this show, we occasionally hear from people that have things go sideways on them, but we have a lot of listeners, and that is so rare these days compared to the way it was when they first started in this racket.
Yeah. I think about this in conjunction with Apple Photos. Similar deal, right? There are files somewhere all the way down there, but there's a database on top of them. And again, they're syncing with iCloud. They're being backed up with Time Machine and Backblaze because my photos are local on disk because I have enough space for that. And at some point, you do just kind of have to, it's a trade-off like everything else, right? I'm trading off the ability to sync with iCloud for not quite being able to get my hands around my files the way I used to, right? There was a time for years and years where my photo library was on Dropbox and I used something like NVAlt, where my text files were just in Dropbox. And I've gotten to a point where I want the features of these applications, all the great stuff Notes does, all the great stuff Photos does. And I've been willing to let go of the file system a little bit to do that. But I do that because the sync's been good for a long time and I run Time Machine and I run Backblaze, et cetera, et cetera. So again, I don't think it's got to be something that keeps you up at night, but there are options, right? You can export them. You can send them to Obsidian. You can do those things every once in a while if it helps ease your mind, but it doesn't, like I said, I feel like we've kind of moved past it a little bit.
Yeah, I agreed. With Photos, however, I am very particular about, in addition to all the other backup means, I just back up the pictures folder. Off of my root drive onto external drives. So if the cloud fails and everything goes wrong, the Photos library is there. And I don't do it as exports because you could go in Photos and they do have a system where you could export everything.
Yep.
But I don't do that. I just have a copy of the library. And I always feel like if everything went wrong, I would be able to get it off one of those backups. One other thing on Notes while we're talking about it, when we did a Notes show, I mentioned this Alfred plugin for Notes Search, which I had kind of found in the research for that show. Man, I love that plugin. I use it all the time now.
Me too.
You know, yeah, it's just so easy. You just type in space and then the name of a note and it goes to it for you. So if that one passed you by in the last episode we talked about Notes, go check it out. I'll put a link for it in the notes here.
Yeah, it really is. It is so, so good. One of my favorite things about it, I can just hit Command space in and it will sort. I think the default is it sorts or shows you the last, you know, half dozen notes you've edited, which I don't use the notes. I sort in notes by alphabetical order, but to quickly jump back into something I was just doing, I use Alfred for it. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. And yeah, it's awesome because it lets me quickly get into something like from anywhere on the Mac. And you know, that's the whole reason for an app like Alfred or Launch Bar or whatever, to be able to jump quickly to something else, to get into something else from wherever And it's awesome. If you're running Alfred and use Apple Notes, you 100% should install this thing.
So MacBook battery management. Jonathan wrote in about an app called Al Dente Pro, which I hadn't heard about. Sets a limit on how much a MacBook battery will charge. Interesting. There were more of these apps like this back in the day, where, you know, battery memory was more of an issue. But the idea of Al Dente is it prohibits charging above 80%. But if you have an unregular schedule, this will not work and start to charge up to 100% just a little bit later. With Al Dente, you take full control over your MacBook's charging behavior. Furthermore, you have to disable optimized battery charging in macOS settings to avoid interference with Al Dente Pro. I looked at it, but I'm not sure I want to go to this level.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Apple has this built into the system. I think as we talked about on that episode, it's definitely not perfect. There have been times where I've grabbed my MacBook Pro off the charger and it thinks at least it's 100%. And Apple even does some stuff for like fudging how macOS reports it. It kind of reminds me of the disk space thing where it's like Finder and system info don't always agree on how much free space you have and kind of vague. And that is frustrating. And I do understand, like, I am the typical user of having a notebook that's plugged in 90% of its life. And I do worry a bit about that battery. But I've just gotten to a point where I'm going to trust what macOS wants to do with it. And this app in particular, and I don't mean to pick on anybody, but it feels like this app is doing some stuff that I'm not necessarily comfortable with. Like you mentioned, it can prevent a Mac from sleeping. It can also disrupt the battery calibration process. The website also just doesn't instill a lot of confidence, like in some of the things in like the FAQ. And I'm not sure I want a third-party app in between like my MacBook and its charger. And so I'm kind of willing to go with what macOS does. Now, if you are concerned about it, you know, there are options out there. But kind of like the notes thing, that's why I put these things back to back in the outline. Kind of like the notes thing, I'm just at a point where like I trust the system to sort of manage itself. And yeah, like, I mean, I'm, you know, to be completely honest, like I'm not super thrilled with my, if I look in system information under power, you know, my maximum capacity on my MacBook Pro is 90% after just 71 cycles. You know, I kind of wish the capacity number was still higher. It's an M2 Pro that I've had since whenever the M2s came out in 2023. So yeah, maybe it's degrading a little faster than I would like, but it doesn't keep me, not to the point where I want to install something third party to deal with this.
Yeah. I mean, there was a day where I was all over these apps. I used to have them. I forget what the name of them, Katie and I used to talk about them on the show, but I feel like the battery science has advanced to a level and Apple has addressed the problem in the operating system to a level.
Yeah.
'Cause back in the day, they didn't. It just, you plugged it in and it charged until it was full and then it stopped. And I just don't think that, you know, that's the case anymore. I think they themselves are taking action. And I just worry about a third-party app and Apple's own process conflicting. And I don't know. I'm just not a big fan of this right now. And maybe I'm getting too simplified in my older age, but I just don't think it's worth the headache of it. I don't want to damage the battery, obviously, but I don't think these apps are going to damage the battery, but I just don't want the built-in system and the third-party app to be getting an argument over how much battery charger should be and cause trouble for me. Either way, yeah, I get it though. I mean, I think that's something we all do is we obsess over battery, even though the people listening to this show rarely probably get below like 50%.
Yeah. I had this is unrelated, but a couple of nights ago, my phone did not make it to its charger overnight. I've got the 15 Pro Max. So when I woke up, my phone was at like 25% or something. It's the lowest this phone's been in a long time. And I kind of thought, like, how far can I get through my day before I charge it? Like, before I hit, you know, single digits. And it was surprising how far the 15 Pro Max can go. Sort of an average workday for me, right? I'm mostly on my Mac. It was sort of surprising.
Yeah. I've been toying with the idea of just leaving my phone downstairs in the studio when I go to bed.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm really thinking about it.
That's what Jason does. The Snells leave their phones in the kitchen, I think.
Oh, do they? Yeah. See, if my kids were younger, I would 100% do it. I'd say, okay, we're all putting our phones here before we go to bed. And,
yeah,
you know, that would I think, work. I think the parents have to do it too. But
I think so too. And for me, I keep it on the bedside for my parents, right? They're both in good health mostly, but they're, you know, late 60s. And it's like, there have been times where I've gotten that call, right? And that's important to me.
Listener Richard wants to know how we're using our action buttons. This is an interesting question. It's come up in the Max Markey Labs recently too, because now it's been, 6 months-ish since the iPhone Pro came out with an action button. And a lot of labs members saying, you know, I'm just not really using it much. You know, what are you doing with it? And I thought it'd be fun to talk about. What are we doing with our action buttons, Steven?
Yes. So for me, at first it was like, I'm just going to launch the camera. But then I realized, okay, there's about 1,000 ways to do that.
Yeah.
And so for me, I'm using it with shortcuts. And I really think that's the best feature of the action button, that, yeah, it can do these simple tasks tied to the OS, but then like, oh, you can also hook it up to a shortcut, and that means it can do basically anything. I love that Apple included that. Honestly, didn't necessarily think that they would, but they did. And so for me, it's a very simple shortcut. I've got a link to it in the show notes. All it does is give me a text box where I can type, and what I type goes into my inbox and Todoist with a due date of today. Very rarely are those tasks something that need to get done today, but it's a way to make sure it gets highlighted for me to maybe sort out later. And so if something comes up, I need to do something, hit the action button, type into it, and then it'll be in Todoist waiting for me when I get back.
Okay, mine is more complex than that.
Yes, it is.
How deep you want me to go down this rabbit hole?
All the way, man.
Okay, all right. So I'm using a shortcut as well, but it is a complex shortcut. If you ever listen to the Automators podcast, you know that I like those. So what I do, I've got I'm using if statements in shortcuts. So the first one is an if statement looking to see if the phone is face down. And so that's the first one. If the phone is face down and I hit the action button, then it mutes the phone, just kind of like the old thing did, right? And my thought on that was, well, if I've got it face down, and I probably don't want it to make any noise, so I can hit the action button. And it's funny, because when I originally built that shortcut, I made it toggle, but then I realized, oh, that's not good, because I could be turning the mute off by that. So I just made it, no, it just turns the mute on. I am doing that with a third-party app called Actions. Coincidentally, just yesterday, Rosemary Orchard told me that there's a new built-in face down detection in the built-in actions in shortcuts. So I'm going to update it. But the one that I put in for the download is using the Actions app. So, you know, sometimes you have to go to third-party apps to get something that's not in shortcuts already, and Actions is a good one. So either way, the first thing it does, it says, hey, is the phone down? When I push the button, it checks. Oh, if phone's face down, then turn on the mute and stop the shortcut. So that's all it does. But then if it's face up, then it says, okay, what focus mode is he in? And then it does a bunch of different things depending on what your focus mode is, because I really operate on focus modes, like 100%. And like right now, I'm in podcasting focus mode. And if I hold down the action button, it's going to give me options to turn on the recording light. Send a text to my wife and kids saying I'm podcasting, leave me alone. Just like all the stuff I do related to podcasting on my phone can appear when I hold the action button down and I'm in podcasting mode. I can get your time zone. I can get Rosemary and Mike's time zones. You know, just like the stuff I need. So it's a real useful way to make it contextually aware. And I love the idea of using focus modes to turn your one iPhone into 10 iPhones. Yeah. You know how there's this thing now where everybody buys, I forget the name of it. There's like this phone that is like kind of intentionally stupid. It doesn't do much. And everybody's buying this phone saying, I need, you know, to get away from distraction, so I'm going to get this one. You could totally do that with a focus mode. You don't need to go buy a new phone. But either way, so I go through each focus mode, and generally what happens is it looks at what focus mode you're in and then runs a choose from menu command. And when you see mine, it's not going to work for you because you don't have all my same app profiles and focus modes, but you'll be able to go through and just, you know, rewire it. So a lot of them are choose from menu because that just makes it easy. If there is no focus mode, interestingly, it lets you choose a focus mode, you know? So if I just hold it down, it's like, oh, I'm not in a focus mode because I'm pretty much in a focus mode 24/7, except when I go to bed. Some others are interesting. I did the Disneyland one. I have a Disneyland focus mode. That one's triggered whenever I'm in the neighborhood of Anaheim. And it does a bunch of things to my phone. It puts on like the ticket app and puts on the timer and the stuff I use when I'm at Disneyland. But it also turns the action button into a sole purpose camera button. So I get the camera button just when I'm at Disneyland, you know, because that's when I need it. You know, you're at Disneyland, you run around, you see Mickey Mouse, you hold down the action button, the camera pops up, you can take his picture. Other ones I have, like a personal one, I'll just go through them. In the personal one, it is brings up like my Kindle app, my nap timer, you know, journal entry, YouTube, stuff I want to do when I'm on personal time. If I'm in a focus mode for work, it gives me a bunch of time tracking, you know, lighting setups because I shoot video a lot. I have different lighting setups I'm going to use. What else I have here? I also have a thing where I can capture into OmniFocus with it when I'm in work mode. A production mode for me is a little different. That's even more locked down because then I'm actually shooting video and I've got a bunch of options that come there related to lighting. When I'm in do not disturb mode, I can turn on dark noise with a thunderstorm sound or capture a thought into drafts. So all of this stuff for me is contextual and it sounds a little nutty. And if you look at my shortcut, it will even seem more nutty, but it actually really works. And as a result, I use it all the time.
I think that's the real key there is taking some time and shortcuts, building something that fits where you are and what you want to do. There's rumors that it's going to come to all iPhones. And I suspect that probably will happen at some point. I don't know about this year or not, but I think it's here to stay. I think Apple changing the button on the side of the phone is a big deal. And I think tying it to shortcuts is just a big of a deal.
Yeah. You know, and there is this rumored capture button. And my goal for that, I actually hope that is just hardwired into the camera. You know, I think that would be good, you know, because I think a lot of people just want a button they can reliably push to get to take a picture. But I'm really glad the action button exists. And to me, it's evolving over time, but I really like it and use it all the time. I guess that's why we're on the Mac Power Users. This episode of the Mac Power Users is brought to you by 1Password. Protect yourself, your family, and your global workforce with simple security, easy secret sharing, and actionable insight reports. Go to 1Password.com/MPU for 20% off. 1Password is so much more than just a password manager. It's an entire security suite. With 1Password, you can manage your online security from a single place. With secure password sharing, automatic password generation when creating new accounts, and data breach alerts always at your fingertips with 1Password. It actually keeps track of the companies that you've got passwords with and lets you know if they've had a problem with their security. Once you're a 1Password customer, you can sign into any account on the first try every time. From passwords to passkeys and everything in between, like signing in with Google, Apple, Microsoft, and other providers. With 1Password, you can autofill everything. So stop hunting for information, save and fill usernames, passwords, two-factor authentication codes, form fields, and password information automatically. And best of all, you can store and share with confidence. Whether it's passwords, credit cards, medical records, even the front door codes, keep it all in 1Password, then securely share with your family or friends or coworkers. You can send individual secrets to anyone, even if they don't use 1Password. Both Steven and I use and trust 1Password. I've been a paying customer since the product premiered so long ago. They've just taken great care of me, and I love having 1Password at my back, protecting my security on the internet. So whether you're a family, an individual, or a company, they've got options for you. Just head over to 1Password.com/MPU right now for that 20% off and check it out.
We spoke about Freeform on a recent episode, our revisit after it first came out a few years ago. And there's a lot of interesting discussion on the forums over some things that people are doing with Freeform, right, beyond the examples we spoke about. A few that I want to touch on, and then you've got some, then you have some also some interesting feedback. But 4 uses that jumped out at me. One was building a family tree, which seems like perfect use for Freeform. Yeah. There are some specific applications out there for that. My wife has been putting some of this together with like one of her great aunts, and she's using, I think it's called Mac Family Tree. I'll put a link in the show notes to it. It's been around forever. And now it's on the App Store. Like, I think the first version of this I got her was in a box from the Apple Store, like an actual box software used to come in. Remember that?
I remember that. Yeah, I do.
What a time.
The software wall in the Apple Store.
Yeah, exactly.
Even more so, I remember CompuCenter's Mac room before there was Apple Stores, and you would go to CompuCenter and they had it, all this PC stuff everywhere, and they had a little room with Macs and a wall of software. That's where I first bought Omni Outliner.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. So Family Tree, I think, super, super smart, right? You can have very, very graphic pictures, dates, arrows, lots of cool stuff there. We had several people talk about teaching and then collaboration in the classroom, including a conversation I saw about basically having a Freeform board while teaching that students can then interact with. Like, you share an iCloud link, and if they've got a Mac or iPad, they could join that and mark it up in real time with their classmates. I think that's also super clever. And then media shopping list. So having a board with books or movies or whatever you want to check out, but you can use the artwork from the book cover or the movie poster and organize it visually. I think that's super smart. My media shopping list is like a bulleted list in Apple Notes, but you know, it could be fancier.
Yeah.
And then lastly, managing details when playing a long video game. A lot of modern games, right? Very story-driven, big worlds to explore, and a lot of things to keep up with. And Freeform can be a great way to do that too. So hopefully that sparks some more ideas in people, because whiteboard apps are literally open-ended, right? You can kind of make them whatever you want them to be.
The latest one I started is a newsletter workflows, because this second quarter I'm really focusing on fixing the Max Sparky newsletter. By the way, if you'd like to sign up for the Max Sparky newsletter, I'll put a link, because I'm trying to get it going better. But I built a board with different scenarios where newsletters go out and how they're done and what they contain and what the key points are, because I have a team member now and I want to eventually share that with him. And I'm really enjoying kind of building it out visually. It gives me a chance to really think, because I'm a visual thinker. So that's just one more use for it. Somebody wrote me and asked, you know, they like Freeform, but they want something more powerful. And what would I recommend? To me, I think the next step up beyond Freeform, especially if you like are in a mixed platform environment, is Miro. I just really like Miro. It's a web service. You know, you got to pay to play, but it's a nice and alternative infinite canvas diagramming tool. But I'm trying to stick with Freeform. I think I would prefer it. And because of the workflow with the Vision Pro, I think it's even more useful.
I think we spoke about Miro back in the first Freeform episode, and I spent some time with it and checked it out. It is very nice. And if you do want something that's cross-platform, that definitely limits your options. But if you're all in the Apple system, you know, Apple ecosystem, and that's where the people you're collaborating with are, Freeform's free and built in and really good.
We have a listener, Burn, and I think Burn might be in Max Sparky Labs too. I don't remember, but every time Burn sends me an email, I always make sure to read it, because he does like crazy stuff, and Burn delivered, you know. This, he set up an entire control panel with Keyboard Maestro, because he likes to use all the keyboard shortcuts, And he built an entire control panel for Freeform using Keyboard Maestro. So, you know, based on, as he wrote, they're almost, Freeform's almost complete lack of toolbars, I made my own. And I thought it was clever.
Super clever. If you look at this, I mean, all sorts of like floating tools. And I think that sort of thing is where Freeform gets to be a bit weird, because it is cross-platform, right? Because it's on the Mac and iPad and Vision Pro, that sometimes like the Mac-iness of those apps can be a little bit shaky. And I think using Keyboard Maestro to make up for that is really cool.
Yeah. That's living the dream right there.
It is. Some people in the forums have talked about the same concern with Apple Notes as far as backing up whiteboards. It's really kind of the same thing, right? Like they're buried in a container. They're in your user library containers, Freeform. But there's no human readable data in there.
That
directory on my computer is about 60 megabytes in size. So it's got something in there, but I sure can't read it as a human. But one thing, I think we mentioned it on the first Freeform episode. I don't think we touched on it on the second, but I'll reiterate it here. Exporting a Freeform board as a PDF is pretty sweet. Like it knows how big the Freeform board is and just makes the PDF kind of wrap around it. Like it gets the size correct. You don't have to do anything weird, like tell it where the boundaries are or how much space you want around things. It's just a very nice job on its own. And now PDF is the only export option, but once you have a PDF, you have anything, right? You can open it in preview and save it as a JPEG or whatever else you may need. And that's not backup, right? Because they're PDFs, they're not living Freeform documents, but it's a great way. You know, we talk about this with OmniGraffle. This is going to be a really useful tool for making graphics for something like a keynote deck or an email newsletter or the web or anything else like that.
Yeah. I mean, and I guess we're both kind of in the Apple trust zone on all this stuff. And if you're not, then that's going to be a problem for you. You know, iPhone cameras. We've seen questions before about those green dots you see in videos and sometimes photos in low light with the iPhone. Steven, do you know what the cause of that is?
For my reading of it, it's light being refracted inside like the stack of lenses. So light comes in and ideally it goes straight through the lenses and hits the sensor. But in low light conditions, we get really bright lights and dark areas. You get some internal reflection in that stack, if you will.
It's almost like an internal lens flare, is my understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, I think my limited understanding is I think that's pretty accurate. And it shows up in those green dots, right? We've all seen them. You take a picture of a building or, you know, kids playing in front of the Christmas tree or whatever it may be, and you get those green dots. And in video, they can be really distracting, right? Because they're moving, but they're not in line with the light source. It's better than it used to be, I think. But in the iPhone 16 line, it's rumored to be even better. They report that Apple is looking into a new atomic layer deposition equipment, like process. And so what this could do is it could apply anti-reflective coating basically in between all those tiny little portions of the lens stack. And it would hopefully continue to knock down that effect when you're using your iPhone in low light conditions.
Yeah, like how do they come up with these names? Atomic layer deposition. That could literally mean anything to me.
I know. But it would be great. I mean, it can be frustrating. And if it's on a photo, like you can Photoshop it out, I guess. But in video in particular, it can be pretty annoying. And I feel like it's one of those things. I see it on YouTube all the time because so much on YouTube is shot with iPhones. It's really kind of incredible once you start realizing it. And that's always a telltale sign. It's like, oh, here's a video of this car I just bought, and I'm giving you a tour. And you see like these green shimmery reflections as they pan across the headlights, you know, the front of the car. It's always a tell. And I'm sure Apple doesn't love that it's there. I certainly don't love that it's there. But we've all kind of gotten used to it. But that doesn't mean Apple doesn't want to improve it. And it sounds like they're going to.
Yeah. And I think today, more than ever, cameras sell iPhones. People buy new phones because they want a better camera, and Apple is aware of that. So my guess is they are not being stingy with a checkbook and trying to solve any kind of problem with the camera system or any feature they can add to make it better. I think that is what brings people to the store every year to buy a new one, or every couple of years.
I think that's totally true. Just the other day, it's anecdotal, but it fits. A friend of mine texted me. He's like, "Hey, I'm looking to buy a new phone. The 15 is free on my plan, or I can spend like $150, I think it was, and get a 15 Pro. What should I do?" And I think she's coming from like an 11, maybe.
Yeah.
I was like, honestly, I spend the 150. I mean, I didn't even get into like, you get a better processor and it's titanium. I didn't get any of that. I just said, the third camera being the zoom. I didn't even talk about the difference between the Pro and the Pro Max, but I was like, the zoom camera is fun and it gives you more options when shooting. And I think she's going to go with the Pro just because of that, right? The rest of the stuff, I didn't bring it up because I knew it was not going to matter to her. What she wants to know is, what's the difference between the cameras?
I just had the conversation with my sister because she wants the big phone because of it's easier to read text when you get older. And I told her, well, now they have a less expensive big one. You don't have to get the Pro anymore. And she said, well, what's the difference? I said, the zoom lens, basically, you know, for her, that's the only thing that matters. You know, the titanium doesn't matter. The processor. She's like, oh, I don't need a zoom. And that was the decision matrix for her.
Yeah. It's kind of wild, right? But people, that's what these things are to people. It really is. And
it's a camera with a phone inside it.
Yeah. Yeah. If it never made phone calls, some people would be okay with that. I think I'd be okay with it.
That's why I don't understand these dumb phones people are buying, the anti notification, you know, minimal phones, because they don't have as good of cameras. And there are things on the iPhone that are still really good that you're not going to get elsewhere, but go figure.
Yeah. I don't think I understand that either. The iPhone's great. You know, there's a reason things like AI pens and other things struggle, because smartphone is pretty good and people like their phones. This episode of Mac Power Users is brought to you by NetSuite. Here's some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, multiple systems, and delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you get to keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more now. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, and more into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, and it can be accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major businesses' processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Finding ways to cut costs and boost business performance is really important right now. It's tough out here for small businesses, and NetSuite gives you the tools you need to do just that. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financial program for a few more weeks. Head on over to netsuite.com/MPU to learn more. That's NetSuite, netsuite.com/MPU. The link is in the show notes. Our thanks to NetSuite for the support of the show and Relay FM.
Steven, I put what I felt like was red meat into the outline for you.
Yeah.
So we redid the sounds for Mac Power Users, and we talked about how the new sounds are kind of based on Mac sounds, and with extra love and attention by Jim, you know. And but there's more to it, and we didn't go completely down the rabbit hole. A couple of these really stand out. The first one is the startup sound, and that's what we start our show with. And I thought it would be fun to talk about it because there's some elements to this. I wasn't even aware And I don't have what a musician would call perfect pitch, right? Perfect pitch is where you can hear a note and know what it is exactly. But anybody with perfect pitch that has booted up a Mac may realize that the original boot up sound on the Mac is not in any key, any Western key, you know, it's somewhere between F and F sharp. And it's like a unique sound that is not on any other, you don't hear it anywhere else because nobody is working in that soundscape, you know, in that microtonal space between F and F sharp. And a lot of people were thinking, well, gee, that was so smart of them. They came up with a way to play the chord where nobody else is going to play the same chord because nobody else is going to choose to go in the middle of two pitches, right?
Yeah. And if for some reason you've never heard, I don't know how you haven't, the Mac startup sound, we'll play it for you now so you can hear it. So you're saying it lives kind of in between notes.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's very strange that it does. And there's a story behind it. Jim Reeks was kind of the guy who made a bunch of these sounds when he was at Apple. And he wanted it to be really kind of uplifting. And it's a, he wrote it as a C major chord. We've got an article we're going to share with you if you want to go down the nitty gritty. He wrote it as a C major chord. And but he, the way he did the intervals, there's a third on top and an E on top, which it just works. It sounds great. Mm-hmm. But at some point when it got implemented, the engineering staff adjusted the pitch with the computer. You know, somehow they, you know, in computers, pitches can be any at any interval, right? Or they can be at any range of hertz. And somehow it got adjusted without Jim realizing it. And it came out to this oddball F/F sharp thing. And that's the funny thing about the article is the author of the article thought this was an intentional act by Apple to carve out their own space. But it's no, it was just implementation screwed it up and it ended up, so it landed somewhere between F and F sharp.
and they've tweaked it over time, right? The tone at the beginning of our show is actually from a Quadra AV. Not quite exactly what we have today. And it even went away for a little while. Remember that? Like in, they're in like the bad MacBook Pro years. No startup sound.
That was sad.
What are you doing? It's such a such a fundamental part of what the Mac is. I feel like getting rid of it was terrible. And they brought it back. It has been tweaked a little bit. I do find it super interesting, the complexity behind it, because it's something millions of people have heard, you know, millions of times around the world. You don't even think about it, right? And we hear it a lot less now than we used to. You used to restart your Mac all the time. Yeah. In fact, we'll get to death sounds here in a few minutes.
Yeah.
But you used to hear that sound all the time, right? At least the older versions. And as Macs have become more stable and better, you restart less and less. It's this like little piece of whimsy, right? Some people worked really hard on it and really thought about it. And it's like, this is one detail in a sea of 1,000. It's so cool and a special part of the Mac, I think.
Yeah. And just to kind of finish up that story, when it came to the Mac power users, Jim fixed it. He put it solidly in the key of G. So he went up above F sharp to G. So we have a G major chord to start our show. So if you listen to it, it'll sound a little different to you than the Mac startup sound. I hope you're listening, Apple lawyers. We're using a different key.
Sorry.
but it sounds a little different. And to me, I actually think getting it out of that weird zone makes it more uplifting. I think it's more normal.
That's interesting.
But that's just me. But yeah. We are very fortunate to have Jim in our lives. He did such a great job on it, and there is a whole story behind it. And we'll give you the article link so you can read about it. But if you're a musician, it's kind of interesting, and if you're not a musician, it's kind of fun to hear how this stuff happened. It was really a mistake. It wasn't intentional.
The other story you put in here was about Sosumi. That is a classic macOS alert sound. It's just a simple beep, right? It's nothing too complex when you hear it. This came about in the early 90s when Apple was putting together System 7. And the name Sosumi is a little bit of a protest. And so back 100,000 years ago, Apple Core sued Apple Computer. Apple Core being the label for the Beatles, like their business entity they were involved with. And they sued Apple Computer and said, you can't do music because you have a name too close to ours. And that'll confuse people. And Apple Computer settled. And part of the agreement was they were prohibited from using its trademark on creative works whose principal content is music. This has sort of come up after the Apple IIgs was given a synthesis chip for sound and music creation. And so they've settled this case, but they're going to put alert sounds in a System 7. And Jim Reeks had put together some sounds. And one of the first alert chimes, the name was too musical. They were afraid, oh, we're getting too close to what we said we wouldn't do. And Reeks apparently got frustrated with this. And
do you know what that name was, though? Do you know
Let
what
it Beep?
Yes.
Which is
Let It Beep.
A great pun on Let It Be. Clearly, the legal department was not going to okay that. You can't, I don't think they wanted to, you know, poke the Beatles again with that. And so he came up with a new name. SoSumi. It's spelled SOSUMI. So it doesn't look like SoSumi, but it sounds like SoSumi. And again, just a very simple beep, very just straightforward sound.
And then he told legal that it was a Japanese word. And he was very specific to never say the word out loud in front of legal.
Which just, what a move. What a move. I absolutely love it.
All right. So then they updated them in what, Big Sur?
Big Sur. Yeah. New, you know, they had some new UI stuff. They did some new sounds. And we've got a video in the show notes to Steve over at Mac84. Did this great video at the time comparing them all. And so SoSumi was replaced with a new sound called SoSumi, SoNumi. So it's like the new SoSumi. So it's like layer on layer of jokes with this name.
Yeah.
And we'll have Jim drop in the original SoSumi followed by the new sound now. They're a little different. A little different.
Yeah. But it's all in the same vein. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I generally like the new sounds in macOS. You know, they've been around 3 or 4 years now. And they're all just sort of softer, more modern takes on those originals. And I think they totally work. I think some people were upset by it, but I think they fit our times better.
The funny thing is I almost never use any of these alert sounds. In most apps, I turn off all noise whenever possible. So although it's a fun road to go down, I actually don't really hear these much at all.
I don't have an alert sound turned on the Mac. I don't have the volume feedback turned on. I don't have interface sounds on in Finder. I just don't want to hear them. But a lot of people do like them. And I think it's fun if you're that type of user. I mostly don't want them because I do audio on my Mac all the time. It's like I don't want random sounds happening.
Yeah. But there's another piece of this. You did a great story back in 2021 over at 512 Pixels called The Mac Chimes of Death.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So in addition to the startup sounds, there was a period of time where Macs would come with a death sound that would play when the machine was unable to properly boot. You know, maybe the system folder was incorrect, or it was trying to boot from a network. I mean, who knows why, right? A lot of things went wrong in the classic macOS. And so I have all these sounds, and some of them are pretty simple. But the one I want to draw attention to is the one used on the Power Mac 6100 and 7100, which sounds like a car crash. Why would you have that as your... Imagine, you're trying to get your work done, your computer crashes, it won't come back up, and you hear this sound, that's not a comforting sound to hear. It's terrible. I'm glad these did not survive very long.
This episode of the Mac Power Users is brought to you by ZocDoc. Go to ZocDoc.com/MPU to find the right doctor right now, and you can sign up for free. You shouldn't have to feel awkward talking to your doctor. The good news is ZocDoc is the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable and actually listen to you. And we're talking about tens of thousands of doctors here, all with verified patient reviews. So you can make sure they're the right fit before you meet them in real life. With ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with a receptionist. And these docs all have verified reviews from actual, real patients. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed, credible doctors and specialists. You can filter specifically for one who takes your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is just between 24 and 72 hours. That's it. You can even score same-day appointments. I remember the first time I used ZocDoc, I was thinking, why didn't I have this before? Why didn't this exist before? Because booking a doctor is insane. You have to find the right phone number. The insurance sends you the booklet, but then the guy doesn't have the insurance anymore. And you spend all this time just trying to get a doctor, literally hours. ZocDoc solves that for you. They find you patient approved in your insurance. Whatever it is you need, they have it for you. This is the simple button for getting a doctor. Anybody looking for a doctor they can trust that's near them with their insurance, check out ZocDoc. Go to ZocDoc.com/MPU and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/MPU. Once again, that URL, ZocDoc.com/MPU. Solve the problem of getting a good doctor at ZocDoc. And our thanks to ZocDoc for sponsoring this show and all of Relay FM.
Listener Allison wrote in asking us about some of our favorite Apple Watch apps, which I thought was a great question. I feel like the beginning, right, Apple really pitched apps as a big deal for the Apple Watch. I think kind of famously, the first generation of those apps were pretty bad because they were basically just projected from your phone, kind of janky, very limited in what they could do. But in the years since, it's become more and more of a real platform. And in fact, technology like Swift and Swift UI, a lot of that was developed for the watch first and scaled up to Apple's other platforms. So David, I'd love to hear about maybe some of the apps that you find useful on your wrist.
Yeah, it's not many, to tell you the truth.
Same.
But there's a lot of informational apps that are useful, like all of the airline apps I have on my phone, because I like that, you know, when I'm in the airport, it gives me the ticket and information, that kind of stuff that feeds you information. But things that I actually push a button on and trigger that are not already built-in widgets, there's only a few that I use. Whisper Memos by far is the most. I've just really fallen in love with this workflow lately. Whisper Memos is a subscription-based Whisper AI transcribing app. So you push the button, you can talk up to 15 minutes, and then it transcribes it. I talked about this, I think, last month on the show, but the magic of this app is that it has an automatic mail feature, so it mails it to any email address you want. And I combine that with Drafts, which now has a mail drop address. So if you have a Draft subscription, you get a secret email address. And I can just send, so I can just talk to my watch, and then text appears in the inbox in Drafts. And this used to be what I did with the Drafts app on my watch, where you would push the button and you would talk to it. But I find Whisper Memos is better at this because, you know, it's doing the transcription somewhere in the cloud. The Whisper stuff does a better job of transcribing than Siri, and I don't have to follow along with the words on this little screen. I can just talk. So I use that app every day multiple times, and I capture email text and blog posts and ideas and tasks and you name it. I speak it into my watch. In fact, on my watch, because I've got the Ultra, I've attached it to the big orange button. So I just push the orange button and off it goes.
Oh, that's cool.
Whisper Memos wins for me by far. OmniFocus, I do check on it occasionally. But there's just looking through my apps that I have installed, they're mainly apps that spit up information at me more than apps I work with.
Yeah. I think that's really the key. I think going to your watch to like get a bunch of stuff done can be really frustrating. It's small. Text entry is going to be based on voice, although they do the thing. I don't know when they added it, but at some point they added it. You know, if you're typing on like your Apple TV and your phone will get an alert like, hey, you can type over here. The watch does that too now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
which is pretty nice, but then my phone's in my hand, and why wouldn't I use my phone, right?
Yeah.
So Whisper Memos, Drafts, OmniFocus, all great. For me, I think the best Apple Watch app, maybe period, is Carrot Weather. Apple's weather app is good, nice, it's great. If you want more, we've talked about Carrot Weather a lot over the years, but the Apple Watch app in particular is pretty outstanding. It really crams like the entire, just about the entire experience down onto your wrist. And in fact, the Apple Watch app won Apple Watch app of the year by Apple back in 2021. We have a link to that story in the show notes. And it's fantastic because you can just see the upcoming weather, see the radar, everything right on your wrist. The complications are very customizable. So Brian gives you lots of options, and then because it's Carrot Weather, you can kind of build your own if you want. It's all very, very nice.
How good does it do at keeping up with the weather? The third-party apps that display information like calendar and weather apps, I always feel like they're a little bit behind the native apps in terms of getting me up-to-date information.
That definitely can be a problem with any third-party app, any third-party complication. I feel like it's as good as any of the others. I'm sure Apple Weather's a little bit faster, but most of the time I watch, I'm just going to do like a quick check. And as soon as you open the app, it refreshes. And so even if the complication's a little stale, I know that the app is going to be ready to go.
Yeah, I wish Apple would make changes so these third-party apps don't have their hand tied behind their back that way.
Me too, man. Me too.
You can talk about sports alerts?
Yeah. So sports alerts is the other one. I've talked about it before in conjunction with the live activities and Dynamic Island on the iPhone, but they also have an Apple Watch app, and you can set the complication to your favorite team. So you can kind of see what's going on just at a glance, but then they do have the sort of the more complete experience on the watch that you can then dive into and see your following teams, you know, see when the next games are. It's pretty awesome. And your sports alerts is very simple looking on the iPhone and Mac. It's very stock looking, but it in there hides a lot of great features.
Nice. So I wanted to go down this rabbit hole further since we're on the Apple Watch, and I thought it'd be fun to do a face check-in. You know, what are your favorite faces these days?
Most of the time I'm using modular. It's a computer watch. I'm fine with that being a computer watch. Yeah, I like having, that gives you, if you don't count the date and time, it gives you five other places to put complications. I put the calendar in the middle so I can see what's next really easily. And then I actually have a couple of modular faces set up, and they're the same except for the complications along the bottom. One, I have more geared towards workouts, like fitness is there, and a couple other apps, like Pedometer Plus, I keep on that sort of my workout mode modular face. I just switch in between them kind of as I need to.
Yeah. I am really into the Ultra watch faces, the modular Ultra and the Wayfinder faces. And I still make, again, you know, I talked earlier about focus modes, but I have a different watch face for every focus mode. So I can just look at my wrist to know which focus mode I'm in. And so I've got a variety of them, and sometimes it's like color highlighting or whatever, depending on what I'm doing. But kind of when I go to the weekend, I go to the analog watch face, and otherwise I have a version of modular Ultra with colors and widgets to accommodate whatever my mode is. Like right now I'm in podcast mode, so I've got, you know, widgets that show me the time in Memphis, the time in London, and, you know, the weather and when the sunset goes down, so I know if I need to put the blinds up or not, if I'm recording with a video camera, and, you know, timers and just the various bits and bobs I use when I'm podcasting or recording.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fun kind of making faces specific to each focus mode. And then when you check the time, it reminds you, oh yeah, I'm podcasting. You know?
And,
or if I look down and I see the podcasting face and we're finished, I'm like, oh, I need to change my focus mode. So it's all good. The follow-up question, of course, to your Apple Watch faces is your Apple Watch complications. We talked about third-party apps, but what are the complications that you rely on?
In addition to the ones I've already touched on, I think Todoist would be the next one on the list. And I think for you, it's very much like OmniFocus. Like, I want the alerts from Todoist, but then I can also go in there and quickly, you know, check something off if I've done it.
Yeah.
Not really entering tasks on the watch, hardly at all. It's mostly for going in and, okay, I'm at the post office. I can just pick up my wrist and check off, go to the post office because I know it's done.
Exactly. I really think text capture for me, right now, at least, is entirely through this Whisper Memo workflow. And even if it's going to end up in OmniFocus, I'll put it in because I just like using my voice and not having to think about it. There are several that are Apple based complications that I really like. I just thought of a better day is one you told me about that I use all the time now.
Yeah,
that's really a third party. I should have mentioned it earlier as an app I use, but I use that one as the date replacement and any face I use, cause it's just better. I like the version where it gives you the day in the month and that, but also has a ring around it showing the progress of the month. I just kind of like the look of that. So I use that one primarily, but by far my favorite, Apple complication is the timer. I use the timer all day long. I love it. I use it for meditation sessions. I use it for work sessions. Just timers are a great thing to have in your life, you know, to say, okay, I want to focus for 40 minutes on this project and set a timer. And then suddenly it's real, like it's go time, you know? And so having a timer on your wrist is very handy. If you've never tried it, I would check it out. I like the fitness rings. I like to see how I'm doing during the day. Two that have really kind of come up, their stock has raised, in my opinion, are HomeKit and Remote. Both of which are very useful. If you got an Apple Watch and you haven't tried them lately, like when I finish the night, sometimes the lights don't go out in the studio. I have some automation stuff that doesn't always work, but I've got the HomeKit widget. So I just hit HomeKit and push one button and it turns the lights off in the studio right on my wrist. Same thing, my house, other people, they don't put the remote where it is. They are not respectful of the remote protocol in my house. I don't know what to do about it, but that is a thing I deal with. It's my struggle. But I can always override and go to my watch and press the remote button. And that's in the personal focus mode. You know, it doesn't show up when I'm working, but when I'm in personal time, if I want to go on TV, I can hit the little remote button and trigger it. And I can fully control it. The only thing I can't do with it with my setup is volume, but we rarely change the volume on our TV anyway.
Yeah, it's come a long way as a platform, but at the same time, I really wish that they would continue to move the ball forward, especially in the realm of watch faces. We've been saying it for years. Letting third-party developers make watch faces would be awesome. Having third-party complications update as reliably as first-party ones would be awesome. They need to keep pushing these things forward. But I definitely feel like the watch has settled in for me as a few notifications come to it for triage, and then the rest of it's fitness tracking and looking at the weather. And you know what? It's pretty good at all those things. And I'm happy to continue wearing it because the trade-off for me is worth those things that I get out of it.
Yeah. I recently spent some time on Instagram. I'm not very good at social media, but for whatever reason, I was bored and I opened Instagram and it immediately started feeding me these ads of these watch face apps. Somehow Instagram got my number, and they're beautiful looking watch faces. And I made the mistake of clicking on one of those ads just long enough to figure out that the ads are completely BS. And like the faces in the ads aren't even possible with the app. And it's a subscription-based nightmare hellscape, right? They want you to, oh, just push this button and install the app and you pay $20 a month for our watch app face, whatever. And it's not even the good ones. So those are bad. But it did remind me, wow, this could be so much better if there was just a way for developers to make faces. It would be so much more fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just look at the way everybody went nuts, for customization on the iPhone, just the limited amount that we're allowed to do now. Could you imagine if we could do it with our watch faces? There was a study years ago about they put a shark in a tank with a fish, right? And then they put a glass like wall and divider in the middle of the tank. So every time the shark would go to eat the fish, he'd bang his nose into the glass. And they do this for so long. And then it turns out if you lift the glass out after you do it for so long, the shark won't eat the fish. Hmm. I'm the shark at this point with watch faces. I've been banging my nose on this glass so long. I don't even ask for it anymore.
And that's exactly when they'll give it to us.
Yeah. Yeah.
This episode of the show is made possible by Sanebox. Sanebox makes email manageable. It learns what email is important to you and filters out what isn't. And it works with all kinds of email programs and services. You don't have to use a special app because Sanebox basically gives you mail folders with superpowers. So some examples include Sane Later. This keeps your inbox clean and full of only what really matters and puts the rest in a place you can go deal with on your own time. There's Sane Black Hole, where you unsubscribe with a click, send a message to the Sane Black Hole, and you will never hear from that sender again. You can snooze and set reminders. I love these features. I very often will snooze an email that maybe I get late on a Friday to the next Monday for work. I don't want to see it over the weekend. It just hangs out and then appears back in the inbox on Monday as I expect. There's also Deep Clean, which is this feature that Sanebox has to help you clear out old unnecessary emails and attachments. You can move those attachments to Dropbox and other cloud services. It's really a comprehensive tool to make your email more manageable. They have various pricing plans starting as low as about $4 a month, and there's a 14-day free trial. So go to sanebox.com/MPU and you'll receive $25 credit on any plan. This is definitely something I could not live without. I have it on all three of my email accounts, both my work accounts and my personal account. And Sanebox just, I can't imagine my email without it. I use all these features all the time. So go check out that 14-day free trial at sanebox.com/MPU. And 2/3 of MPU listeners who try Sanebox end up subscribing, and I bet you're going to love it too. Once again, sanebox.com/MPU to receive a $25 credit on any plan. Our thanks to Sanebox for their support of the show.
All right, Steven, what are you playing with these days?
Oh, man, I've got a big one, and that is the Arc browser. This is a browser that's built on Chromium. I'm sure lots of people have experimented with it. I'm a little late to it. There were some invites that cool kids got. I was not a cool kid, but it is really different than any other browser I think I've ever used. Some of the differences I feel like are just there for differences' sake, and I don't really love that, but there are a lot of interesting things about it too. It does a good job with multiple profiles, so you can have like sets of bookmarks and stuff, kind of flip between them easily. Safari has that, kind of. Chrome has it a lot. Arc has it too, in some more visual and interesting ways. The thing that kind of irks me currently is blurring the lines between tabs and bookmarks. I've got a lot of bookmarks. I launched them from Alfred mostly, and that's fine. But in Arc, in the sidebar where your tabs and your bookmarks, they're all kind of the same thing. And they just get a little line when they're open in a tab somewhere. And like, it's kind of weird because you don't have a tab bar. It's some of that's kind of strange. And I think they're just trying to take the friction out of that for people. But as someone who understands how tabs and bookmarks work, I'm okay with how they work in every other browser. One thing it does that I think is really interesting, and we've mentioned it in other apps, is they've got a sort of a command bar right in the application, something like Obsidian or Craft or others have, where when you hit Command T for a new tab, you get basically what looks like a search box. And when you do that, and start typing, it will pull in things from your bookmarks or a Google search if you don't have, you know, if you're not matching with something. And then you can have like previews and some other things in there. They integrate with like your Google Calendar or Gmail or Outlook or GitHub if you want to do that. A lot of interesting ideas. But I think for me at the end of the day, it's kind of too many interesting ideas. And I've been trying it for about 3 weeks and I still feel kind of uncertain what I'm doing at times. Like, oh, where did that tab open? Because sometimes things can open in a pop-up. You can put them in a side-by-side sort of split view within the app window. A lot of that's interesting, but it, again, I don't think it's for me, but I wanted to give it a fair shake. And so I feel like I have, and I feel like I kind of know what it's doing like 80% of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I've been playing with it a bit too, and I still like Safari, you know? And I want to spend more time in it. I think I get why people love it because it feels to me like it's a killer feature is tab groups done right. And if you've got like a set of 10 or less tab groups, you'd like to be able to just jump between them quickly. It has it right there in the sidebar. It's totally visual. I've tried to make tab groups work in Safari and they're just never quite right for me and they don't remember. And like, I feel like that's a feature in Safari that needs additional work where this app kind of nails that. And if that's what you're looking for, it's worth checking out. And
yeah.
It seems like a lot of people are really into this thing and it seems like the developers are really invested in it. So I'm very curious to see where this goes because this is the first kind of third-party app, browser app that I've had interest in a while, but I'm playing with it with you like you. For me, it is also not love at first sight, but it is interesting.
What about you?
You know, you were talking about the command tab, and that reminded me of an app that I got in the last, I did a labs video on it like 2 months ago, and I am like totally sold on it. It's called Paletro. Have you ever heard of this app?
I have not. Tell me about
this. It's part of Setapp, but you can also buy it. And what it does is it gives you a command palette in any app you're in, and it searches the menu bars and lets you run any command from the menu bars with a keyboard shortcut. It's Shift Command P. And I was using it because I'm working on the OmniFocus field guide and it's like really useful to like dig into deep settings on any app. But I really like it. And it is, there is like this move. I think Obsidian kind of got me started on the idea of a command palette and that why not have a command palette in every app? And that's what this kind of is, Paletro. And I would recommend checking it out. It digs through all your menu items for you. So you hit Shift Command P and you type any whatever app you're in, it seems to work. It even works with Notion, which is, you know, I think it's Notion is not a native Mac app. I don't know what that app is. I'm assuming it's Electron, but
I think so.
But it works, you know, and it just kind of goes through and you start typing letters and then it'll remember the most recently used one. It'll put those at the top. And I think it's just a really useful little utility.
I'm going to try this out. This looks really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Really useful. I'm also reading a good book. We don't usually talk about books on the show, but I just started reading Adam Savage's Every Tool's a Hammer. And
oh, yeah, it's like, good.
Yeah. Have you read that book? Yeah,
I did. I read it when it came out. I'm a big Adam Savage fan.
Yeah. Good guy. Seems like a really good guy.
I think so.
I wonder if he's a Mac power user. Maybe we should try and get him on the show.
Sometime. You know, there's some old video. I don't even know if I could find it, where he talks about working on big long-term projects, how at least at the time he's using Evernote and he would like dump everything he could find about an object into Evernote. And then when it was time to work on it, would like pull it up.
Yeah. No, thanks.
If someone knows Adam Savage and can get him on the show, let us know.
Yeah. If he comes on the show, we're going to fix him. All right. Well, listen, these feedback shows are always fun. For those in the more power users pools, stick around. We're going to be talking about Godspeed. But otherwise, we want to thank our sponsors today, 1Password, NetSuite, ZocDoc, and SaneBox. We are the Mac power users. You can find us at relay.fm/MPU. We love having you here. We hope to see you again next week. Have a great week, gang.